Welcome back, everybody, to the Tour de France edition, the Between Two Wheels podcast, episode 135. I hope you've enjoyed the first four stages. We're going to go over those, some results, some revelations of stages one through four, the Tour de France. We're also going to give you a little retrospective of the 30-year anniversary, 1989 Tour de France edition. Greg LeMond, spoiler alert, he wins it. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to do some things that make you go, some winners and losers. So hang on. Welcome, everybody. Thanks again for joining us for the Between Two Wheels podcast. I hope you've enjoyed the first, four stages of the tour. It's been pretty exciting. Look, sometimes these first week of the tour can be a little bit boring. I've actually enjoyed what they've thrown out to us with starting in Belgium, getting some little bit of the pitchy climbs there. Look, we had an exciting first day with some wrecks that have kind of changed some of the development of the stage. Then the tame time trial coming up on stage two. Then we had yesterday's version of stage three with some more climbs and some surprise finishes, or was it? And then today we had a full-on natural, typical sprint finish. I'll get into all that. It was clean. It was good. It was interesting. So we'll start. Let's start way back here on Saturday. And the stage one. So it was a jaunt through Belgium. Look, we had some historic climbs out there. Greg Van Avermaet goes out there. He decides to pick up the King of the Mountain jersey. He does so. He sits back up. Everything is then coming down to a sprint finish. And with that sprint finish, inside the last 3 kilometers, you had a wreck. That wreck took down probably the favorite for that day, Dylan Groenewegen of the Jumbo Visma team. Took him down pretty hard. With that, also took down Geraint Thomas, and we'll get into the kind of the crashes that took place in general. But what ended up happening was, you know, inevitably a little bit of a split in the field. You then get a little bit more of a chaotic sprint coming up. And with that, you have some guys not on their lead outs. Some guys had to stutter. And what you ended up having was, as always, Peter Sagan working his way through there, not having a team to really lead him out, but just surfs his way through to the front. And ends up with a great finish. But he gets pipped on the line by Mike Tunison of the Jumbo Visma team, who had been the lead out for Dylan Groenewegen, and he ends up taking the win. What was interesting about that sprint is it had a little slight bend to the right. You had Caleb Ewan, who looked good. He just kept having to stop and stutter because he wasn't quite getting through. You had Tunison on the left-hand side taking the wind and just being able to just free flow his way up. He gets on his teammate Wout Van Aert's wheel, and he gets basically free shot to the line, unencumbered, and he had a really good turn of speed. It was interesting to see Caleb Ewing, who looked fairly good, and I expect to see some more out of him coming up soon. But what you ended up seeing was Jumbo Visma. They get the win. They get their first leader's jersey, the Netherlands do, and not since 30 years. Well, and we'll talk about that in our 1989 retrospective Tour de France historic little revision there. So Mike Tunison is from the Netherlands. He's Dutch. He gets a yellow jersey. It's the first one since Erik Breukink. It's a long time for such a cycling-centric nation and such good riders, but that's the way it was. With that, you had Caleb Ewing that looked fairly good. Viviani was up there in the mix. Peter Sagan, he looks tremendous as always. And Groenewegen hit the deck and looked like he was not going to be very well. Now, what other consequences did you have from that day? In that same wreck, you had Geraint Thomas going down on the right side of the road. If you watch the replay of the crash, you had Geraint Thomas, Team Ineos. He's last year's winner. He hits the deck pretty hard as well. Seems to be okay. What was also interesting is earlier in the day, you had a crash by Jakob Fuglsang. Jakob Fuglsang won the Dauphiné this year. He's won a bunch of early season races. He's looked really well, really good. He's kind of coming in as one of the favorites, even though he's kind of unproven in the tour as far as getting great results. He goes down pretty hard, and we had a cut to his temple area, and he ended up going to the hospital. He's been cleared. He's been still riding and doing fairly decent. But what was interesting is, and I retweeted this on my account on Twitter, was it looked like a Bahrain Merida guy went down, and everyone's praising this because they thought it was Nibali, because Nibali, great wizard on his bike, but it wasn't. It was Tantric. The guy goes down. It might have been Mahorik. I'm not sure exactly who the rider was. He goes down. He's on the left side of the road. He falls down. His bike's kind of on his right side, and he's sitting on his bum, and he sweeps his bike to the left, like he's going to move it out of the way for everybody. But in so doing, he just bike whips Jakob Fuglsang and has no ability to do anything other than just head over his handlebars and hit the deck pretty hard. Tantric, his teammate, Bahrain Merida guy, jumps the curb and he's able to avoid it. But man, when you look at that, it looks like an intentional, and it wasn't intentional to take out Fuglsang, but really hard bike whip, just throwing his bike, spinning it around him, kind of counterclockwise as he's sitting there, hitting Fuglsang and having him go head over heels. So that obviously is going to be, look, I don't like to see any of the GC favorites taken out by crashes, but that's what you have in the first week. Everyone's super fit. Everyone's ready. They're all fighting for his position. And boom, one thing happens. Okay, so what happens the next day? Next day, we have a team time trial. It's around 27 kilometers. It's in and around Brussels once again. And first team to go out was Team Ineos. That's because they take it due to their time. Now, look, I'm not going to break down the racing here. I'm just going to talk about some issues and some exciting little points of interest here. People speculate that Ineos is so, they do everything calculated. So therefore, since they were the first team out, which means they were the last place on Team GC, they had planned it. Well, when that wreck happened, I don't think they planned that because Thomas went down. They don't have a sprinter and they're trying to keep guys up front. I'm sure they were trying to stay up front so they'd have a decent position for the team time trial. Because what happens is you have the team time trial, you go out in reverse order of your team GC, general classification. And with that, you'd like to at least see some times that the other teams are doing so you can keep on track and to pace yourselves accordingly. They were the first team out, so they weren't able to do that. I don't think that they were able to plan that they were the first team out. So whatever. I think that's giving them too much credit. It's like, Sagan, like when you hear Phil Liggett, Sagan can't do any wrong. He never, ever hits the deck because he's so amazing on his bike. Well, he's very good. Obviously, he's very good. But let's dial back the hyperbole just a little bit. So Ineos is the first team out. The very last team to go out that day was Jumbo Visma, because they were actually the team, not just in the yellow jersey, but they had the team GC as well. So they were the last one. And what you end up is a book end here of Ineos sets the fastest time. No one could come within it. There's a pretty good bunching of before Jumbo Visma comes in of 1 through 10 of, in 20, 40 seconds or so. Matter of fact, second place comes in Dequena Quick Step, 0.8 of a second, less than 1 second behind them, but they were still second place and had a good little bunching there. And then Jumbo Visma comes in. They've had good time checks all along the way. And when they cross the line, they crush them by about 20 seconds. And I say crush them because everyone else, like I said, there's a 1 second between first and second, down the line, 20 plus seconds further off. I mean, let's go through some of these too. So like I said, Ineos was the first out. Jumbo was last. Jumbo smokes them by 20 seconds. Him some surprises on the day. Simon Yates gets dropped by the Mitchelton Scott. Look, he came off of the Giro. I hope he, obviously he didn't get time cut. I say obviously because he's still racing, but it didn't look super good for that team. And I think that would have helped if they had a little bit more power there. And hopefully he's able to come good for the mountains for them. He also got dropped on stage 3 up the climb. That's just not good when such a good climb. I hope he's not overcooked. I hope he's just kind of tapering his way through. But Mitchelton Scott was a bit of a surprise for not looking that great. They weren't too bad, but they didn't look good. Like I said, Jumbo crushed everyone, which really helped them, giving Kruiswijk, their GC rider, a big advantage over everyone else. Last year in the team time trial, he lost 42 seconds to Ineos or to Geraint Thomas. Now, Ineos didn't win it last year. I think BMC did, but I'm talking to Thomas in that respect. Then he lost another minute or so in the individual time trial. So now this year, he puts 20 seconds himself on Geraint Thomas, which, in a respect, that's almost a minute in a sense, because he lost 40 before, now he gains 20, and it's kind of a reversal of that position. Instead of being down by 40, he's up by 20. So I think that bodes well for him. It was also interesting that team jumbo. They looked really smooth. They kept George Bennett, small little climber, in the group. He looked like he was just tailing off. Everyone else was filling in before him. He was taking tickets, so to speak, at the back. He wasn't really taking his poles till the other end. And it was good to see him finish up there as well. But Kreuzwick did look very smooth in that line, and maybe that will come good for him in the individual time trial. Another big surprise with Thibaut Pinot, Groupama FDJ. They're only down 32 seconds. It's a huge improvement for Pinot and his team, actually coming good there. And by contrast, the other French rider, Romain Bardet, they lost a minute 19. Minute 19, that's not so stellar. And now look, these are two jumbo. So 32 seconds down for Pinot to Kreuzwick. Well, you're only down about 12 seconds to Thomas. But, you know, Bardet loses over a minute. So not so good for them. Other ones that were not so great either was Trek with Richie Port's team, Movistar, UAE. They're all over a minute behind. Movistar, I don't know. Maybe they, with their three-pronged attack, maybe, I know Landa said he wasn't doing good. And so, I mean, do they wait for all three of those guys if they're having trouble? I don't know. He said he was baggage. UAE with Dan Martin, that's not going to be helpful for him as well. Other results, EF Education first, they did well. They were 28 seconds off of them. So look, 8 seconds off of Tini Minios and Garrett Thomas. That's pretty good. Bahrain Merida, 36 seconds. Those for the GC teams. Like I said, 20 quick step lost out. They missed out by just 21 seconds for third place. They got that 1 second off of Ineos. Sunweb and Katusha both at 26 seconds. And that was kind of a surprise for Katusha. They did well. Then the very next day, though, you see Ilnur Zakarin having trouble up one of the climbs. Matter of fact, he was there with Simon Yates. Stage three. Yesterday, you had stage three. It's got some climbing stuff in it coming to the end, some cat threes. You had Tim Willens off in a break early. He ends up hanging on up to the last, you know, categorized climb. I think he was trying to get the King of the Mountain jersey, and he was raising his arm at the bottom of the climb. Well, it looks like he had some sort of mechanical. I couldn't tell if it was a flat tire, but about halfway, two-thirds of the way up the climb, Alaphilippe just puts on a stellar attack. Mike Woods kind of goes. A few other guys kind of go. I think Landa, they go over the top. They're not really interested in catching him. They let him go. He gets quick 30 seconds down this descent. Have another little pitch up. Then he gets another, and he's up almost a minute. Teams are kind of charting a chase, and in the end, Alaphilippe stays away, gets not only the win for the day, but takes the yellow jersey because Mike Tunison of Jumbo Visma was dropped, so he was not going to be in there. But then the whole team had won the team time trial, so everyone is up there. Wout van Aert, he's next best place to take over 20, and now he ends up not being able to take the yellow jersey because Alaphilippe does so. Alaphilippe wins the stage, but what you did see coming in next was, you know, a smattering of second tier punchy climbing sprinters. You had Michael Matthews ends up winning the field sprint, who, you know, I've called him out saying I think he's, and he was going really well today, similar type of finish, well, not a similar finish, but a similar climb before the finish, about 15K. We'll talk about that, but he did look very good as far as getting up and through those, you know, he beats Sagan, he beats Van Avermaet, he beats Wout, he beats a bunch of these guys that can really go over. Now, my prediction is that, or thinking is, Alaphilippe had a very good chance of winning this stage from a bunch sprint, okay? But he decided to go out about 15K and really dig deep and take it on. What this also says to me is that he really is in the stage hunting mode, and he's looking to get a yellow jersey early. I don't think, you know, I've had Mike Sayers in here talking to us, and he thinks that Alaphilippe really will develop into a GC rider. I think if he was committed to the GC general classification overall win this year, he would not have done that bold move 15K out, because we saw that last year at the Giro. With Yates taking off so many times, Simon Yates, you know, hitting it out, winning, you know, taking steps where he didn't need to, and by stage 19, he finally just folded. He was kind of burnt out. That's a speculation, and I don't think that's what you're going to see out of a GC rider now. So therefore, I think Alaphilippe, while it was a great move, I think he's just looking to get his team in. You know, they do have Henrik Maas who can have a chance at the overall, and I think he has a better chance, and he's had the better record in the tours, you know, top tens to do than Alaphilippe. that Alaphilippe is stage hunting. He gets that win. It was awesome for them. And, you know, the French guy winning on French soil, getting his win is pretty impressive. Like I said, coming into the lead field was Michael Matthews. I think he's in form. He looks really good. And you're going to have a bunch of these stages still where you're going to have a chance he's going to still have a chance to win. And you never know about the green jersey. I don't know how close he is there with Sagan. We'll have to take a look at that. But that will be developing coming up. Okay. Then today, so you have, let's do a count. Jumbo Visma 2, Jequani Quickstep 1. All right. Coming into stage 4, Reims to Nancy. This was today, 215 kilometers. The profile, look, it's a slightly downhill finish, typical sprint stage that you'd see. But like I said, coming in about 15, 16 kilometers, there's a summit, a Cap 4 summit that did look pretty difficult. So the sprinters were going to have to get over that. And what you ended up seeing was you had a break, Mickey Schaar, Alfredo, and his teammate, Tuanti Group Gobert guys, and Mickey Schaar of CCC. Off in the break, they get caught. Then all the sprinter-ish teams, and I would say that but the Michael Matthews type, well, specifically his team, goes to the front on the climb to try to get rid of, you know, Caleb Ewing, Viviani, Groenewegen, and they went pretty hard, but the field never split up, so all those sprinters ended up making over. And then what you saw was a sprint finish coming into Nancy, which, look, what do we know about Nancy? It's let's talk about Reims first. During World War II, the city suffered additional damage, but in Reims, 2:41 on the morning of May 45, General Eisenhower and the Allies received the unconditional surrender of the German Wehrmacht. Germans surrendered there in Reims. That's where the stage was started. Nancy, Phil Anderson won the stage there in 1982 in Tour de France. A little historical perspective. We'll try to get some of that continued as we go. Okay, so now we have the Tour de France coming into the stage. These roads are wide open. It gives every train an opportunity, and you saw Jequani Quickstep kind of holding back. I was specifically trying to watch Groenewegen, and he gets coming up to inside 2 kilometers. Wout van Aert, his teammate in the white young youth jersey, basically he comes up to the front. He starts to take over, and you see Mike Tunison near or about 2 wheels behind, and he's looking back, and Groenewegen's not there, and he's looking for Groenewegen. And so I think their interpretation of that was, I don't know, we kind of lost him, we're trying to have to surf. And I was watching Groenewegen, he was holding wheel, and then he would lose it. He would get on Alaphilippe, he lost a place to that. Then he gets on Sagan, he loses a place to that. And in the end, he has to do a lot of fighting to try to get up there for when the sprint does hit. And when the sprint does hit, it's Jequani Quickstep leading out Viviani, Markov, I'm not sure the other rider that they had up there. They blitzed it up the left-hand side. You saw Caleb Ewing getting on Viviani's wheel. He never really has a chance to come through. Alexander Kristoff of the UAE team, he blows up through the middle. He doesn't end up being able to overtake. He gives the best competition to Viviani. Caleb Ewing comes there. Sagan's on the right. And then you have Groenewegen kind of just sitting up and Tunison. So what you ended up seeing was Ilya Viviani gets the win. Alexander Kristoff in second, Caleb Ewing in third, Sagan in fourth, Groenewegen and Mike Tunison fifth and sixth, which is weird because Tunison's his lead out, and I don't think he's decided that he's going to, you know, make these big changes to being a sprinter since he won stage one. But I think he thought perhaps since Groenewegen was out of the picture again, maybe he's still injured. He's at least going to go for the sprint and see what he can do. And he was making some time up or some positions up. He was carrying a lot of speed into the finish, almost pipped his own teammate. Dylan was kind of sitting up. I think Dylan had, when he started to hit the gas, he was moving, but there was just too much road debris. In other words, you know, other riders coming back at him, and he didn't get up there. So those guys need to get back on the wheel, figure out what they're doing, because I think Groenewegen is at least still the best, to me, the best sprinter in the group. The best potential, well, at least. If his injuries aren't too bad, he'll have a chance. But he's got to get on his teammate to clear out the way and to clean it up for him a little bit. Same with Caleb. Caleb's a rider that has to hit the front, and he has to hold people off. If he gets caught behind him, he just, like today, he didn't be able to start his sprint. And that's with most sprinters. You want to start the sprint when you want to start the sprint, not when someone else is. And there was just too much wide road. And like I said, Dylan got off his guy. There's some other things. Real quick here, because I saw Nizzolo, Giacomo Nizzolo of Team Dimension Data, He ends up in seventh place, and we'll talk about that in a little bit as far as his role with the Tour de France and kind of why we think he's even there. So finishing out the top, Jasper Stuyven, Trek Segafredo, Michael Matthews in ninth, Christophe Laporte. You go down a bit, Andre Greipel, 12th place for Team Arkea Samsic. A lot of good sprinters. It was clean. It was at least that part I was really good to see. All right, let's talk about a little bit of the history of the Tour de France. 1989, 30 years ago, my friend Tom said, hey, you're doing some of these. Did you talk about Greg LeMond? Because I talked about, you know, 15 years, 50 years, 25. No, I did not. Hey, it's the 30-year anniversary of Greg LeMond winning the Tour de France in 1989. We'll go over some of the things. You probably know about him. There's just some interesting perspectives of that. That race we know as the closest race in Tour de France history, 8 seconds, won by Greg LeMond. What's interesting about it is Pedro Delgado, who ended up third place. I don't know if you know this, but he missed his start time. Maybe you don't remember it. He missed the prologue start time by, so he when he ended up coming to the start and going down the ramp, he was 2 minutes and 40 seconds already had elapsed for his time. That's not good for a guy who had just won the year before the Tour 1988 Tour de France by 7+ minutes or so. So, you know, look, you have a chance, but that's never a good way to start it. Eric Breukink ends up winning the race, the prologue that year. Like I said earlier, he's at least a Dutch rider. Last time we've had a Dutch rider in the yellow jersey up until Mike Tunesson for this year. Pedro Delgado ends up at the overall race third at 3:34. So, but for that, you never know what that changes. I mean, what's that, 56 seconds or so that he would have been if you take away the 2:40 that he lost. So that was really, the grouping there is pretty tight, especially compared to what he did to everyone last year. Like I said, Dutchman Eric Breukink won that. He was a top favorite for the Tour. He had been for several years. PDM was the team he rode for, a Dutch team. Really good rider. One thing, if you ever look back at pictures of him, he always seems to have a lot of snot running out his nose during time trials and hard efforts up climbs. I don't know what it is, but I just noticed that a bunch. Team selection. It was what was interesting about the team selection for that year. It was the first time that they had wild cards and a lot of teams selected based on their rankings for the year. The FICP is kind of a governing body at the time. They had really been pushing this for the Tour, and they got them to accept to take the top, what, 18 or so teams. What's interesting is Team Ariostia was, by automatic determination that they were one of the teams that would be selected, not in the wild card. They turned down the offer, decided not to do the Tour. That was back then when a lot of the Italian teams just kind of stuck to their own in Italy. He said, no thanks, we'll pass on the Tour, which got ADR, which was Greg LeMond's team, into the Tour. Now, Greg had been having a weird season. He had he'd done horrible in the Tour de Trump. Yeah, they had a Tour de Trump then. Then it turned later into the Tour DuPont. And then the Tour of Italy, he was really struggling with that and ends up on the very last day getting second place in the time trial. I think Laurent Fignon had won the Giro that year. Now, that was also during the time when you had the Giro, the Vuelta, before the Tour de France. So the Vuelta was actually early season as well. And I think Pedro Delgado had won the Vuelta that year. So you had pretty good showing, you know, Vuelta, Giro guys coming in to bit, and then Greg LeMond with a little bit of surprise. ADR, the Greg LeMond's team, they had one of the weakest showings ever. Their team had only three guys other than Greg finish, so four team guys total. They were also the lowest ranked team on the team classification to have a GC winner. They were 17th on Team GC, and yet they still got the overall winner. What was also an interesting thing, you talk about time trials. We had the team time trial 27K. We have an individual time trial of 27K coming up. Back then, they had a total time trial of 190 kilometers in time trials and team time trials. They had a 46-kilometer team time trial, 46K, 73-kilometer individual time trial on stage 5. They had a mountain time trial of 40K, 39K on stage 15. Just bucket loads and a prologue as well. Closest finish in team history with 0.8 seconds to Greg LeMond, overcoming a 58-second deficit coming to stage 21. That's right. It finished on a time trial, stage 21. By the way, that was also a thing that the FICP, they wanted to cut the days, and the Tour de France wanted to have like 24 days that year. They decided to extend it out. They had a double day, I think, on stage two. They did an A and a B, the two stages. It was kind of their compromise. We'll let you have these for sure teams in with some wild cards, but in reaction or compromising with that, we're going to have additional stages. And they ended up having 21 stages, 21 days, 22 stages, I believe it was. Anyway, they're fully loaded there. 7 yellow jersey changes with Greg LeMond and Fignon swapping from stages 5 onward. Notable stage wins, 3 by LeMond that year. I think 2 were time trials. 1 was just a regular stage. Raul Alcala, who had been with 7-Eleven, Mexican, he won a stage. Miguel Indurain won a stage as well. It's kind of the phenom that he became to be, obviously, but that was kind of his starting point. Robert Miller won a stage. Fignon won a stage. Teammates Steven Rooks and Jan Tunisa, both Dutch amazing climbers at the time, and they might have been helped along the way with their fuel. Anyway, they won a stage as well. 1989 tour goes down in history. It's obviously one of those great ones. It's the aero bar kind of taking in that whole. There were so many things written. You know, Greg LeMond becomes Sportsman of the Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year. He won all kinds of awards. He had been down and out, obviously, with the gunshot, winning in 86, kind of the comeback. And then we see, you know, Greg wins. Actually, to me, his most impressive tour, though, this was one of the most amazing, but his most impressive, 86 was impressive as well. But 1990, really, if you watch that one, you get Claudio Chiappucci and some of these other guys. They get a big, big break, 10 minutes plus early on, and he's in the lead. His teammate is also in the lead at some point there. Pascal Simon, that's who it was. He's up there, but Greg slowly chips away from this 10 plus minute deficit, just chips away day by day by day until I don't think he actually won a stage at all in the 1990 tour. We'll talk about that one maybe next year as it's the 30 year anniversary. Some things that make you go, hmm. Missing out on this tour this year, there's big talk about it, is Mark Cavendish. But another one that you maybe not hearing very much about is Philippe Gilbert from the DuPont Quick-Step team. And between those two, I mean, Cav hasn't done much at all this year. But you look at his team, we just talked about Nizzolo. You know, he's top 10 in the sprints. I think Cav probably would be doing that in a stage like today. There was talk about after stage one that, oh, Nizzolo was like fourth. I don't think Cav would have done that. Maybe Cav would have come through that crash just fine. It was a little more of an uphill, so maybe that's incorrect to even give him that. But Steve Cummins is sitting there for Dimension Data on the back. He's not doing much. Nizzolo is not going to win a field sprint or do any better than top 10 in a flat-out field sprint. So I'm kind of a little disappointed to see Mark Cavendish not come. He had 30 wins in the Tour de France. I think the record is 34 by Eddy Merckx. You know, starts in Belgium. Ralph Aldag, their general manager for Dimension Data, said that he's riding as good as he was or better than 2016. Whether that's the case or not, I'm not sure, but we won't know. Philippe Gilbert, on the other hand, you know, look, he won Paris-Roubaix this year. We were talking about him being one of the best riders ever. He did fairly well actually for a while there in the Dauphiné. I'm not sure why you don't include him. You've got Asgreen, some of these other riders. I mean, look, DuQuoin Quick-Step is stacked to the hilt, but to not include former multiple world champion, to, you know, Ardennes Classics winners, won stages at the Tour. He's an ultimate team rider. Some of these little punch finishes yesterday would have been fine for him. It's kind of interesting that they left him out, and especially on the season he had. And that's just the bad thing about being on a team that's so stacked. And I think the rumor has it that he's going away next year to Lotto, I want to say. You correct me if that is incorrect. Let's do some winners and losers. Winners and losers on the day. You had, well, on the first four stages, I think Jumbo and DuQuoin Quick-Step. Look, they're 2-2 now. Each has won two stages. Next, tomorrow, they have a little bit more pitchy coming up on stage 5. Some climbs in there, some 2, I think some 3s, somewhat near the end. And I think you're not going to probably have some sprinters. So is Julian Alaphilippe, is he going to stay in the yellow for that? I think so. DuQuoin Quick-Step, you know, even though they lost Groenewegen, they came out, they won the stage 1, they end up winning stage 2. your tour is pretty much won at that point, but they will still be going for more because Groenewegen's not happy with how this has gone, I'm sure. So he's still going to be on it. Some losers, you could say Roman Bardet and Groenewegen, but I will reserve for that. The Giro Rosa, it's the feminine tour of Italy, is going on right now. And stages 3 and 4 saw similar situations where rider comes across the line, they start to post up, or they do post up, and they get pipped. Stage 3 saw Lucy Kennedy, the Mitchelton Scott rider. She had taken off. She had caught Taylor Wiles in the last kilometer. It's a climby little thing coming up, and she's almost to the finish, and Mariana Voss comes flying by her. She raises her arm, Kennedy does, and Voss gets her by half a bike length or more, the speed that she was carrying. That's pretty devastating. But since this happened, then the very next day, there's a break off of 3 riders. They're coming into the finish. Nadia Quagliato does a similar thing where she's sprinting probably the last 50 meters or so, sitting down, trying to make an effort. And another girl, Letizia Borghese, is coming up on her right. And Borghese does a bike throw. She does a bike throw as Nadia does an arm raise. So if she'd done a bike throw herself, because it was a really tight finish, she probably would have got it. But no, I'm going to do an arm raise because what happened yesterday with the Lucy Kennedy was a freak thing. That's not going to happen to me, but it does. Come on, people. Finish. You can throw your bike. You can post up later. You can superimpose a picture if you want. But what's worse than, oh, they didn't get me. I didn't get a post up at the line of my win. You know what's worse than that? Posting up and not winning. I think we'll save this for next time. There's all these podcasts that are going on for the tour, and there's a lot of good info, and I'm going to rate some of them and talk about some of them. So I've got a listing of some of that. We'll keep listening to them, and kind of my review of all of these, pretty intensive. I'll just say, if you like a lot of ads and you want to hear about 10 minutes of a 30-minute podcast all being ads, check out The Move by Lance Armstrong. I checked in yesterday, and 6 minutes in, they finally started talking about the race. About halfway through, they did a bunch more ads. Hey, all more power to you. I get it. But just be prepared to, if you want some old man reading glasses sold to you, that's your show. As far as insights, I will say, I am doing a review. As far as insights on that goes, George Hincapie's been taking along there, and I will say he's insightful, somewhat humorous, and he's about one of the only people that seems to give shit to Lance Armstrong. So that's good. Lance, I see now he's been on the NBC pod, NBC TV show, news, the feed, the broadcast. They're going. I don't know if they're trying to get clicks. I guess their whole thing is, look, we want to get viewers, and this is the way to do it. Because you know what? Lance does bring it in. I mean, there is still something about him from the American perspective that people love him or they hate him. And I don't know how people are going to react to seeing him on part of the broadcast. But that broadcast is smattered with past dopers, ones that have been alleged dopers. And it's all kind of feeding around the Lance Armstrong, just his persona. So interesting to see there. All right. Well, that's all we've got to today. Tomorrow, stage 5 and then stage 6. Stage 6 is the interesting one coming up on Thursday. That's where they go up the Planche de Bellefeuille. I don't know how to say it actually. But that's the one that has the first big climb in it. And what will be interesting to see that day is obviously who the GC riders are that are coming out to play. How Alaphilippe does, if he is really interested in holding on to this jersey as long as possible, why not? Why not give it a try? I think that day can possibly see him stay in there. But, you know, yeah, I mean, he can climb well, but that'll be another interesting point to see. So stay tuned for that. We'll probably have Chris coming in and joining us for that one. So anyway, this has been episode 135 of the Between Two Wheels podcast. Appreciate you joining along. Hope you're enjoying the tour. Hope you're enjoying some of our coverage of it, some of our takes on it. Check out the show anywhere the podcast can be found. Share it if you'd like. Make some comments. And come back for next time as we give you more of the Tour de France from the Between Two Wheels. Thank you.